I've been, over the last year or so, working on social theories of obligation, which in the Reformed context really is about covenant and the relationship between covenant and, broadly speaking, normative constraint, normative constraints of all kinds. And so this talk bears witness to that. I think you'll hear some of that in some of the details. It's offered in a way in response to Bart's query. At least it's offered in mind. The talk has Bart's query in mind about the prophetic function of the council. So, dignity and domination in Gaudium et Spes. And I've added a modifier. It's mid-century siblings. There's a handout. One of the mid-century siblings that I'm going to consider is the Presbyterian Confession of 1967. I assumed that some in the audience were not familiar with that. So I'm not going to go into the details much of that document, but you should at least know that it's in the background here. So my purpose this morning is to consider four mid-20th century documents on the relationship between the church and the modern world. They are, in many ways, siblings, these four. I want to look at the timeline that connects them and to consider their attention to the question of human dignity and to the problem of domination. By domination, I refer to a feature of certain human relationships, relationships that leave some persons vulnerable to the arbitrary power of another, to power that need not give a due account of itself. The key word is due. So, section one, four documents. On April 11th, 1963, Pope John the 23rd promulgated Pacem in Terris. It was, according to Russell Hittinger, the high point in the effort initiated by Leo the 13th to integrate the modern human rights project with the Catholic natural law tradition. The central concerns of Pacem in Terris, the equal dignity of every human person, the rights and duties that flow as a direct consequence of this feature of our shared humanity, the common good that emerges as rights are recognized and duties fulfilled, and the freedom from domination, from the arbitrary will of others that safeguards this dignity. Each of these themes appears in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous letter from that same year. Written just 5 days later from a city jail in Birmingham, Alabama, Dr. King quotes Augustine's famous remark from Book One of De Libero Arbitrio, "An unjust law is no law at all." The claim, he says, should be put in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas. An unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal and natural law. His examples were close at hand. The conditions of legally enforced racial domination and segregation that he and others were contesting. There were some laws that forced Black Americans to suffer undue losses to their persons, property, and dignity, while enabling their white fellow citizens to use the public offices of the state to secure private gain. There were others that imposed burdens on a minority without their consent and that guaranteed unchecked power to a majority. And there were otherwise just laws applied unjustly, with the aim of bringing benefit to some and undue harm to others. Promulgated roughly 2.5 years later, on the final day of the council, Gaudium et Spes picks up these same themes. Human beings are, and I'm going to quote liberally from Gaudium et Spes in the next paragraph, okay? Human beings are created to the image of God. All have a share in the light of the divine mind. All have a law in their hearts written by God. Their dignity comes by virtue of obedience to this law, in actions that emerge from knowledge and free choice, not blind impulse or external pressure. A collection of basic rights and duties, universal and inviolable, follows from this equal dignity of persons. and justice is done and the common good secured when this equal dignity is recognized and when these rights and duties find expression in every social and political relationship. Concretely, this means that no relationship can be called just that, quote, insults human dignity. That includes, quote, domination by an individual or a political party, unquote, that is structured by unaccountable power and undue authority, leaving one party literally at the mercy of another. The council mentions, quote, subhuman living conditions, arbitrary imprisonment, deportation, slavery, prostitution, the selling of women and children, as well as disgraceful working conditions where men are treated as mere tools for profit rather than as free and responsible persons, unquote. That's from paragraph 27. Finally, in May of that same year, 1965, a first draft of what eventually became the Confession of 1967 was presented at the General Assembly of the United Presbyterian Church in the USA. This is a Presbyterian document, which means it was written in a committee. That's a Presbyterian joke. Okay. One of the things I learned when I moved to Princeton Seminary is that I'm going to sit on endless committees. It's just purgatorial. Although I'm not certain it's purging me of anything. But my point here is that the committee was chaired by Professor McCormick's dissertation supervisor, Ed Dowd. Among these four mid-20th century documents on the relationship between the church and the modern world, the Confession of 1967 is the outlier with respect to the themes of dignity and domination. Offered as, quote, a present witness of God's grace in Jesus Christ, and addressing the issues of the day, racial discrimination, war, poverty, the sexual revolution, C67 speaks in entirely different terms. It does not refer to a natural human dignity or a universal regime of human rights and correlative obligations. It speaks infrequently and ambivalently about justice, and not at all about the good shared in common by those who participate in a rightly ordered social or political relationship. And it does not identify domination as a central feature of social sin, or speak of the need to hold power accountable to the norms of justice. Instead, it refers to God's love for all humankind, to God's desire for a covenant relationship with all people. It speaks of human sin and of the need for God's reconciling act in Jesus Christ. And it accents the effects of this act, a community of faithful people set right with God, reconciled with one another, and enabled by the Holy Spirit to give and receive forgiveness. In faith, this covenant people knows that, quote, God loves and accepts them in spite of what they are. And they bear a present witness to the object of their faith by reproducing this reconciling love as the Spirit allows in all of their social and political relationships. My point in drawing our attention to this distinction between C67 and the other three is not to disparage this talk of reconciliation and love, of relationships forged anew by God's redeeming grace, by no means. Indeed, the other documents speak in roughly these same terms. Gaudium et Spes in particular. Its justly famous paragraph 22 refers to the fact that in Christ's sacrifice, God reconciled us to himself. God delivered us from the bondage of sin, gathered us up into the household of God according to the likeness of the Son, who is the firstborn of many brothers, and so enabled us to receive the first fruits of the Spirit and to discharge the new law of love. Whatever it is that we must finally say about human nature as the root of human dignity, for Gaudium et Spes, it is only, quote, in the mystery of the incarnate Word, unquote, that human nature comes fully to light, and so to our special dignity. No, my point is that unlike these other three, unlike Gaudi Metzpez, C-67 refuses to pair its talk of a covenant relationship created on divine initiative with the discourses of justice. It resists the thought, or more generously, it has no room for the thought, that a covenant relationship with the God of Israel and the Church might have something to do with human dignity and human rights, or with the need to oppose relationships structured by arbitrary power. Power that need not give an account of itself by referring to the norms of justice. The reasons for this resistance are not explicitly stated in C-67's paragraph. It's a sparse document. It doesn't justify its claims much. It's a proclamation. But I think we can tease out two. This is speculation of the good kind. The first reason regards justice as an object of desire and follows from a suspicion that the desire for any good, even the good of a rightly ordered social or political relationship, is, in the words of C-67, quote, infected by self-interest and by hostility to God and neighbor. By these lights, the desire for justice invariably comes with the dear self's desire for its own good. And this makes our commitment to the ideals of justice invariably self-consuming, self-defeating. Justice should regard the person we are obliged to treat justly. It should regard the good they are due and the benefit that comes to them by virtue of the just treatment they receive. This is its basic requirement. And yet, if it's justice that I want, if the goodness its act achieves prompts my will and elicits my choice, then in the last analysis, what I really want is something for myself, the good I desire. In some way, it's my own welfare, my own happiness that ultimately concerns me, not the good of the person I treat justly. Since sin invariably twists my desires, my commitment to the just welfare of others, no matter its sincerity, will always arrive as a hoodwink and a swindle, as an instance of self-interested self-deception. Or better, in the language of C-67, it will always bear witness to our subtle capacity to, quote, claim mastery of our own lives, turn against God and each other, and become exploiters and despoilers of the world, unquote. It's a suspicion confirmed and amplified by the modern habit of speaking of justice in terms of subjective rights, something that Pachamentaris, Gaudi Metzpez, and Dr. King all deliberately do. A right by these lights is a claim that one party makes against another for the performance of some action or the delivery of some good. The person who makes the claim wants this performance, desires this good, and not for the person who delivers it, but for themselves. What other reason could possibly motivate the claim? If these suspicions are sound, then the Church should obviously express its witness to the world by referring to selfless love and the work of reconciliation, while keeping quiet or mostly quiet about justice and its norms. So goes the first reason that accounts for C-67's outlier status. The second regards human dignity and follows from a worry linked to a different suspicion. Both can be inferred from, but not exactly found in, the Confession of 1967. So again, I'm speculating. Inferred from its silences and from the influence that Karl Barth's views had on its content and spirit. The worry is this: an account of human dignity and human rights that begins with our shared humanity, with our rational capacities and our basic grasp of the natural law, in effect begins in the wrong place. At the very least, it shifts our attention right at the start, away from the reconciling work of God in Jesus Christ and toward something else, toward our own rational capacities, rational powers and moral capacities, powers and capacities that can be specified and known, perhaps imperfectly, but known nevertheless, apart from what God has done for us in Jesus Christ, apart from the relationship God has created with us through the sacrifice of the Lamb, apart from the role we now occupy in the household of God. This worry is a variation on Barth's concern with natural theology, and it comes with the following suspicion: that an account of human dignity and human rights derived in some way from our shared humanity in fact naturalizes the contingent. It makes necessary and universal, but in fact is not, presumably in order to valorize some local set of norms and commitments. The thought is that those norms and commitments cannot be both determinate enough to specify concrete action, and yet natural in the sense that they are recognized by all human beings and more or less embodied in their lives. The suspicion is that an appeal to our shared humanity cannot, on its own, do the work of making human dignity determinate enough in terms of content to identify the fundamental rights and specific duties that are said to follow from it. When we make this appeal, nevertheless, the dignity we describe and the rights and duties we identify will not be deliverances of our shared humanity, but projected longings. Offered as harmless narcissism, they will express our desire to have some collection of home truths, our own arbitrary ethic, as Barthes would put it, dignified and justified through reference to human nature, created and shared. Offered by those with cultural power and economic might, our talk of dignity and rights can express a desire to determine the conditions of the social and political relationships in which we stand, to have our home truths regulate the lives of others. Since these benefits are obvious, and since home truths are many, this appeal to human dignity will be commonly and unhelpfully made, quite often on both sides of the most contentious moral and political debates. So goes the suspicion. It's a critique widely shared among the many secular critics of the discourses of human dignity, to which they tend to add the charge of speciesism and worries about disability, about persons who lack the aspect of our shared humanity that is said to confer dignity upon us. In the time that remains, I propose three tasks that will put these four documents in conversation around the themes of dignity and domination. First, I want to consider what C67 can learn about justice and desire from Pagan and Terras, Gaudium et Spes, and the tradition of Catholic moral theology in which they stand. Second, I want to consider how human dignity, as it is presented in Pacem in Terris and Gaudium et Spes, might be reinterpreted, if not recast, in light of the concerns expressed in C67. And finally, I want to consider how Dr. King's light touch with natural law theory might address a problem created for the church and its public witness by the particular recasting I propose. In each case, I solicit Thomas's aid, and yet in the end, I follow Dr. King's lead and pair him with Augustine. I trust that a Protestant can be forgiven this ending, even among the Dominicans. So, justice and its common good. As you've probably gathered, the eclipse of justice in the Confession of 1967 is, in large measure, a consequence of Kantian doubts about the moral status of any human action done for the sake of some good that is known and then desired as a result of that knowledge. In mid-20th century Protestant theology, these doubts found prominent expression in Anders Nygren's famous work Agape and Eros from 1930 and 36, and in Barthes' Christological reworking of the concept and actuality of obligation. In our own day, these doubts motivate prominent efforts to disentangle justice from desire. From John Rawls on fairness, to Nick Walterstorff on rights, to John Hare on obligation and divine command. And note, justice disentangled from desire still confronts that other source of doubt and suspicion, the modern habit of referring to justice in terms of subjective rights and obligations. For Stan Hauerwas, Christians who speak in these terms violate the Pauline injunction against conformity to the world. They speak as the world does in order to secure power in it. Hauerwas's suspicion is the discourse of subjective rights is the discourse of modern liberalism. When the church takes on that discourse, they're basically trying to secure power in the world. For Oliver O'Donovan, rights that are said to adhere to particular subjects by virtue of their shared humanity too easily multiply into competing and irreconcilable claims that pit one individual against another. For Timothy Jackson, it is precisely this competition, this collection of irreconcilable claims and sources of power, that is incompatible with the Christian law of love. It's in the context of these doubts and suspicions, mid-20th century and contemporary, that benefit comes from attending to what Pachamentaris and Gaudium et Spes say about justice and desire. Crucial here is their insistence on a tight coordination, both conceptual and actual, between justice and the common good, whereby a good held in common is an effect of right action, and as a result, a proper object of just desire. Thus, Pachamentaris observes that, quote, one of the principal imperatives of the common good is the recognition of the moral order and the unfailing observance of its precepts, unquote. That's from paragraph 85 of Pachamentaris. Gaudium et Spes concurs. It refers to the common good as, quote, the sum of those conditions of social life which allow social groups and their individual members relatively thorough and ready access to their own fulfillment, unquote. Gaudium et Spes speaks of social groupings of all kinds, from the smallest to the entire human family, and it insists that the right ordering of these groupings necessarily involves rights and duties. Securing that order and the peace that follows from it, according to Gaudium et Spes, is, rightly and appropriately called an enterprise of justice. So there's a tight coordination between the enterprise of justice, the recognition of rights and duties, and the securing of right relationships within social groupings of all kinds, from the smallest to the largest, from friendships to the cosmopolitan community. Thomas puts the point this way. Justice regards human actions that mediate our social and political relationships, friendships, families, citizens' organizations, ecclesial communities, and political societies. This is its proper matter, Thomas says. Those who care about justice care about the conditions of these relationships. They want to perform right actions, actions that deliver to others the goods they are due, because they want to set their relationships right. This is their most basic concern. When, in a particular case, they succeed in this, when they act justly and set a relationship right, the good shared in common is the relationship itself. It is a good they desire for the person they treat justly, a good they hope to secure by means of their right action. Crucially, it is a good they hope to enjoy with the other person. Indeed, they must proceed in this hope. There is no erasing themselves, no refusing this good without denying it for the other, without failing to provide them with the rightly ordered relationship that is their just due. In fact, a relationship set right by justice is a common good par excellence. It is had and enjoyed in common or not at all. The competition between my good and yours, your welfare and mine, so prominent a source of anxiety among the critics of rational desire, is ruled out by necessity in a genuine desire for justice. No doubt, many of our social and political relationships are divided by disagreement about the final ends of human life and about the ultimate condition of human flourishing. Some of our fellow citizens may even doubt that human beings have a shared final end. And among those who think we do, there is disagreement about what it is and how to conceive it. Right? The many varieties of natural law theory bear witness to this. And of course, Christians will insist that a shared conception of our final end is one thing, a shared participation in it quite another. The first is a consequence of wise teaching, the second a deliverance of grace, and grace comes as grace will. None of this can be denied, and yet none of it prevents us, Christians and non-Christians alike, from caring about the conditions of our relationships or about the goods held in common when they are set right by just conduct. Once again, Thomas brings the matter into focus. Temporal justice, he tells us, regards proximate, not final ends. It regards the right order of those social and political relationships in which we stand, not the final end to which we might refer them. The first regards the specific reality of justice. The second, its possible perfection by charity. As for doubts about the merit of subjective rights, neither Pachamentaris nor Gaudium et Spes seems troubled by them, and the reason is simple. In neither document do we find rights reduced to claims that persons make against each other, or regarded as essentially competitive, individualistic, or aggressive. This is Tim Jackson's principal worry, right? So that when you start talking about subjective rights, you're basically talking about claims that persons make against each other, and once you've got persons claiming rights against each other, you basically have conflict and competition. And that seems to conflict with the Christian law of love. But in neither Gaudium et Spes nor in Pachamentaris do we see subjective rights or obligations regarded principally as claims. Rather, in both documents, in Gaudium et Spes in particular, a subjective right is a normative status that comes with membership in a social or political relationship. One has a right. One becomes a rights holder. One acquires this status precisely because one is a member of the relevant social or political relationship. It might be the kind of political relationship that we find in liberal democracies, where talk of rights is common, but it need not be. It could be a relationship of any kind, and so long as it is a good one, so long as it is not structured by arbitrary power, for example, then the rights that accrue to members, rights they have by virtue of being members, these are likely to be good as well. This is basically, I think, the response to Hauerwas. Hauerwas is worried that if you start talking about subjective rights and obligations, you've basically made a concession to liberal democracy. And I want to say, well, yes, liberal democracies do access this particular discourse of justice, but not exclusively. All you need to do is read the historians like Harold Berman and others who talk about the growth of subjective rights in the 11th and 12th century. You've got a different narrative about subjective rights generally. I want to say that there's a different narrative about subjective rights conceptually. A subjective right is like any other normative status that emerges in a good relationship and that survives critical scrutiny. Examples include being baptized, bankrupt, or tenured, being a felon, an infant, or a king, being a married person, a student, or a stranger. In each instance, the normative status deserves recognition from the relevant persons in the social relationship. The person who is baptized, bankrupt, or tenured deserves to be recognized for having that particular status. And maybe the bankrupt person doesn't want to be recognized, but they deserve to be recognized. In the same way, the person who has a subjective right should be recognized for having it, for being a rights holder, for having this particular status within some particular relationship. And the other persons in the relationship should respond to her in accord with the normative demands of this particular status. A rights holder is a person who is due some good from another. And quite often, it's by virtue of the role each party plays within the relationship they share. Thus, students are entitled to certain goods from their professors by virtue of the role each occupies in the student-teacher relationship. Competence with the subject, papers read in a timely fashion and returned with useful commentary, respect in exchanges, grades distributed according to the relevant criteria, and so on. Consistent failure to deliver any one of these goods may well generate a claim for them. And this claim is certainly authorized by the right, but the two are not identical. The rights that a student has by virtue of being a student are one thing. The actions and claims that accord with that normative status are quite another. Nor is the claim made simply to secure the transfer of goods and the private welfare of the rights holder. At the very least, there's no necessity in this. If the claim is justly made, with just aims in mind, then in part what the claimant wants is to set the relationship right. When rights are recognized, when a due response is offered, this is precisely the outcome. And as I said, following Thomas, one cannot want this outcome, this rightly ordered relationship, without wanting it for and with the person who shares in it. This is what it means to say that rights belong to justice, and that justice regards the common good. And note, we speak of rights here, of a normative status that the students carry with them wherever they go, and not simply the just treatment they deserve in accord with the norms of the student-teacher relationship, because, as we know, too many professors fail to act in accord with those norms. They take advantage of the power differential in the relationship and ignore its requirements. They fail to deliver the goods their students are due by virtue of being students, by virtue of being their students. We speak of rights that students have, in other words, because of the importance and fragility of this particular relationship, because setting it right is so crucial, because securing this common good is so often so difficult. We speak of a normative status that requires right responses from professors because students deserve recognition as persons who have rights in this particular relationship. So goes my reply to C67's worries about the self-regarding character of just desire and subjective rights. So now I'm at my third section, dignity and citizenship. This reply to these worries is no more than a sketch, but I do think it gives us one example of what Protestant theologians can learn from Pachamentaris and Gaudium et Spes. It also provides some of the terms we need for interpreting these documents in light of C67's unstated but implicit worry that accounts of human dignity and human rights derived in some way from our shared humanity and its various capacities can be either determinant or shared, but not both. If they are determinant enough to specify concrete action, it's unlikely that they are shared deliverances of our common humanity. If they are derived from our common humanity and shared across time and place, then they might be vague moral generalities, do no injustice and the like, but nothing that can specify concrete action without further determination by something else, from local custom, positive law, acquired virtue, or the gift of grace. But suppose we think of dignity in the terms I've used to discuss subjective rights. Suppose we think of it as a normative status within a social or political relationship. Suppose, as before, we consider how certain roles or offices within certain relationships can generate this particular normative status, how they can dignify the persons who occupy them. And suppose, once again, we distinguish good relationships from bad in order to set apart the normative statuses we are willing to endorse from those we are not. The slave master might have certain rights that come by way of the role he plays in the master-slave relationship, but insofar as that relationship is itself unjust, then so too is that role, and so too are the putative rights associated with it. The same applies to dignity, and the point is crucial. As Jeremy Waldron, the law professor at NYU in Oxford, has pointed out, to think of dignity in these terms as a normative status within a relationship is to think in terms of rank and privilege, of nobility and hierarchy. We are suddenly in an aristocratic world where dignity is displayed in bearing and self-presentation, and where its unequal distribution makes some of its privileges false, perhaps even repulsive. In this world, some are dignified by a superior rank or role. They are immune from degradation. Others might be stigmatized by their lower position in a social hierarchy. They are literally at the mercy of those who outrank them. The higher-ups need not give an account of themselves or of their conduct to their inferiors. This would be beneath their dignity. Their inferiors cannot count on mutual accountability. This requires status and power, precisely what they do not have. Relationships that are in some way equivalent to these deformed ones, that are structured by a similar inequality of status and power, and by the absence of due accountability between ranks, these will be similarly deformed. The normative statuses that emerge within them will be false, unjust semblances of the real coin. If we nevertheless find it useful to think of dignity in terms of a certain bearing, nobility, and immunity from degradation that persons possess simply by virtue of occupying a role within a social or political relationship, then we had better identify a different collection of roles and relationships. This is Waldron's strategy, and he concentrates on the role that citizens occupy in a just political order. In a moment, I will too, but we could just as well refer to the dignity that comes by way of occupying the role of parent, priest, worker, or some other lofty human vocation. Here I'm referring to Gaudium et Spes 21 and 47. Or we could speak, as both Pachamentaris and Gaudium et Spes do, of the special dignity that comes to those who by grace have been made sons and friends of God and heirs to eternal glory. The fact that both documents speak of the dignity that comes to graced humanity, to those who occupy the role of son or daughter within the household of God, brings the interpretive challenge I'm trying to address into focus. According to Waldron, accounts of human dignity have to coordinate two different senses of the idea. There is the sense I have been considering, dignity that comes by virtue of a role or rank within a relationship. And there is the idea of human dignity invested in every human person, regardless of the role or rank from the highest to the lowest. In the modern period, theorists of human dignity have concentrated on the second sense. They have developed egalitarian accounts grounded in human nature and its capacities, and they have dismissed accounts grounded in roles and relationships as relics of an aristocratic age now past. Pachamentaris and Gaudium et Spes offer modern accounts of precisely this kind, and yet, as I just noted, they retain the role-based conception in order to speak of our natural human dignity perfected in God, not annulled by grace, but raised up to a divine dignity. This may be the best way to coordinate these two different senses of dignity within the economy of salvation, an egalitarian human dignity that refers to created nature and a graced human dignity that refers to roles. But for this way to work, the challenges posed by C67's implicit doubts about human dignity and human rights, rooted in our shared humanity, in our rational capacities and our basic grasp of the natural law, these will have to be addressed. Perhaps this can be done. I don't discount this possibility, but I will leave that task to others. Instead, with those challenges in mind, I want to sketch an account of natural human dignity that draws not on our shared rational capacities, but rather on the role of citizen that we occupy by virtue of being persons subject to divine rule. The key distinction in this account is ordinary and well known. The role one occupies as a citizen of a commonwealth is one thing. The activities that one can perform by virtue of occupying that role are quite another. Dignity attaches to the role, to the fact that one is a citizen under the laws, not to the activities authorized by the role, and certainly not to excellence in the performance of them. Ideally, one does not lose the nobility and immunity from degrading treatment that one shares with one's fellow citizens simply because one is incapable of performing the activities of citizenship or because one performs them poorly or viciously. The Alzheimer's patient may not caucus or vote. She may not hold elites accountable or make sacrifices for the common good, and yet she remains a citizen nevertheless, and she retains the dignity and privileges of this role. The abolitionists and the freedom riders exhibited excellence in the activities of citizenship that few of us can match. They deserve recognition and honor for this excellence, no doubt, but not for greater measures of dignity. That status remains unchanged and shared with the rest of us who are also citizens who play this role, but with far less excellence. The images here are not only aristocratic, but also theatrical and legal. And as I read Thomas, he accents each while trying to coordinate the parts through the idea of rational nature. Here I'm going to quote from question 29 on the divine persons from the Prima Pars, article 3 on whether the name of person is becoming of God. And I'm going to quote from reply to objection 2. He's responding to a remark from Boethius. Thomas writes, "As for famous men were represented in comedies and tragedies, the name person was given to signify those who held high dignity. Hence, those who held a high rank in the church came to be called persons. Thence, by some, the definition of person is given as hypostasis distinct by reason of dignity. And because subsistence in a rational nature is of high dignity, therefore, every individual of a rational nature is called a person." Unquote. A person person is someone who plays a role, who has a persona in a drama, in the relationships it depicts. She has a certain dignity that comes with that role and by virtue of those relationships, and this dignity comes with certain rights and requirements, and these often drive the drama. Dignity demands recognition. When recognition is denied, rights might be claimed. When rights are claimed, a drama unfolds. Notice the fallout. If we wish to say, as Thomas does, that we are persons by virtue of our rational human nature, then dignity comes to us by virtue of that persona. The claim is that our rational humanity, our personhood, is a role we occupy, a role that bestows dignity upon us simply by virtue of the fact that we have been given it and now occupy it. Notice as well how Thomas's remarks on the natural law bring this claim into focus and make this dignity determinate. Whatever else we want to say about those remarks, one thing is certain. They are designed to spell out how rational human agency is created and governed by God, how it falls under divine jurisdiction, how it emerges by divine command and is ruled by God's eternal law. This is where the dignity comes in. We are not subject to God's eternal law as slaves to a tyrant's arbitrary whim, but rather as citizens to a sovereign. The sovereign is not a tyrant because he rules with a perfect orientation to the common good. His rule is not arbitrary because his citizens share in it, because they know the demands of his law and are inclined to its ends as a result of their knowledge. Or in Thomas's spare and yet precise idiom, the natural law is nothing else than the rational creature's participation of the eternal law. It is because our participation in God's eternal law is rational, whereby we know and endorse its demands and so share in God's rule over our agency, that we are persons. Persons who play the role of citizens subject to God's rule. Citizens with a special dignity that comes by way of that role. And it is because our dignity is determinate in this special way that due recognition of it has a certain determinate character. At the very least, we can say that our dignity is denied the recognition it is due when, contrary to our role as citizens who know and endorse the demands of the law, we are subject to arbitrary rule, to power that need not give due account of itself. Since the lust for domination is common this side of Adam's fall, so too will this failure of recognition. Thus, we can say that the special dignity that comes to us as we occupy the role of citizens subject to God's rule comes with the right not to be dominated. Note as well how this dignity, and so to this immunity from domination, this right not to be subject to the undue power and authority of another, comes with the role, with the fact that we are citizens subject to God's rule, not with the exercise of our rational agency that this role makes possible, not with excellence with respect to that role, with respect to that exercise. Persons with dignity, we remain so long as we are citizens of this commonwealth, regardless of whether we act in accord with the role we have been given or whether we do so well or ill. The Alzheimer's patient retains the dignity of her role, of her rational persona, even as she cannot act in accord with it. The same applies to the sinner. Quote, every act of reason and will must needs be in virtue of the natural law, says Thomas, in virtue of our status as citizens subject to God's rule, and we retain that status even when we perform vile and wicked actions. So long as we remain reasonably vicious, we retain our citizenship and so too our dignity. And finally, notice how this natural human dignity that refers to roles and relationships, to our participation in God's eternal law and our immunity from domination, comes fully into focus, as the Confession of C67 would surely insist that it must, only on the analogy with the covenant of grace. The dignity that comes with our created natural persona is conceived on analogy with our recreated gracious persona. By grace, we are offered a new citizenship, a new role, and in the language of Pachamon Terrace and Gaudi Metzpez, a dignity made perfect, raised up to a divine dignity. We are dignified by our status as citizens subject to the new law, as persons, individuals of a rational nature, who know and endorse its demands and who are thus, in Thomas's words, ruled and ordered by its precepts suaviter, sweetly. The analogy is obviously formal, but it is also actual, at least in hope. It enables us to say that we were made for this higher dignity, whereby nature's grace is recapitulated as grace. It authorizes the hope that this formality becomes fully actual. This, anyway, it seems to me, is the content of our faith. So, part four, the natural law in Christianity's civic project. One last problem. Russell Hinger has noted how the Catholic understanding and presentation of natural law received an upgrade during the Wojtyla-Ratzinger era, and how this upgrade created a quandary. Both John Paul II and Benedict XVI shunned the minimalist ethic of the manualists. They resisted the thought that the natural law could provide an alternative ethical theory, one different from the standard options on offer among the secular theorists. Instead, they tethered the natural law to anthropology and theology, to scripture and revelation. The problem is that these theologically rich terms make it difficult for the natural law to play one of its traditional roles, to function in Christianity's civic project. Presented in these terms, the natural law can no longer identify common premises across religious and philosophical traditions, premises that can function in public debate about important matters, about the dignity of human persons and their immunity from domination. Hittinger's recommendation is that Catholics retain the benefits of the theological upgrade while simultaneously seeking an alliance, theoretical and practical, with, quote, the dignitarian humanism of the Enlightenment. My reinterpretation of the modern natural law tradition, of its account of human dignity and human rights, generates a version of this quandary. If you begin with the dignity that comes by way of our gracious recreation, by way of the role we have been given in the household of God, given by means of Christ's sacrifice, and if you regard the natural law and our natural human dignity on analogy with this gracious template, then your theological commitments may very well complicate your public engagements. My suggestion, somewhat different from Hinger's, is that we follow Dr. King's example. If our own theological commitments make it difficult to express our care for justice and its common goods, for our shared human dignity and immunity from domination without referring to the natural law, then Dr. King's practice is instructive. Let me try to make it explicit. He assumes that his fellow citizens share a collection of proximate ends, above all, the desire to set their various social and political relationships right. And he assumes they agree in broad outline about the character of a just relationship. At the very least, he doubts that anyone will call a relationship just that is marred by domination, where one party is at the mercy of another, left helpless before arbitrary power and made easy for exploitation. Domination and exploitation are species of injustice. Dr. King addresses his letter to white pastors who acknowledge these basic moral truths and express a vague commitment to opposing these forms of injustice while turning a blind eye to Jim Crow's concrete examples. They are insufficiently horrified by the injustice all around them and unashamed by their desire to go slow, to oppose it incrementally. So he engages in imminent criticism. Their lives, he tells them, do not embody their most basic moral convictions. Indeed, their refusal to impose unjust positive laws and racist social mores cast doubt on their commitment to those convictions. When he speaks of the natural law, the point is to mark this distinction between conviction and convention, to locate it among his own theological commitments. There are moral truths that transcend local, sinful convention. These belong to God's eternal law. The injustice of legally enforced domination and exploitation is one such example. Dr. King does not refer to the natural law in order to remind us that domination and exploitation are unjust. Rather, their injustice reminds us that there are moral truths that rule and measure positive law. Dr. King speaks of the natural law in order to bear witness to this fact. Jim Crow America offered untold examples of social and political relationships distorted by domination and exploitation that betray our recognition of their basic injustice, that violate the natural law's most basic prohibitions. In his later life, Dr. King referred to others, economic exploitation at home and colonial domination in Vietnam. In our own day, we might refer to sex trafficking, the mistreatment of immigrants, judicial torture, militarized policing, and to the mass incarceration of black men. We might also refer to the fact that vast differentials of power, wealth, and social position, combined with weak governmental institutions and strong market forces, have left far too many of our fellow citizens subject to the unaccountable power of others. Even when that power is not exercised, the threat of it leaves far too many feeling vulnerable, hopeless, and resentful. Some even fantasize about exercising arbitrary power of their own, about walling out, locking up, or expelling the scapegoats of their suffering. Others lay claim to that power in acts of organized violence and terror. These are obviously unjust responses, but they are not unintelligible. It's against this backdrop, this contemporary unraveling, that Augustine's wisdom comes into focus. I'm not thinking of the image of Augustine that we find in contemporary political Augustinianism, the image first drawn by Robert Marcus in his widely read and deeply influential Saeclium, History and Society in the Theology of St. Augustine. Marcus gives us an Augustine attentive to the conflicts and divisions that afflict every social and political relationship disordered by sin. Since there is no overcoming these sources of sorrow without God's healing grace and ultimately before the eschaton, and since grace comes as grace will, the eschaton is long coming, our politics must be secular, not sacred, its conflicts and divisions managed but never overcome. Marcus recognizes the benefit this Augustinian image can bring to Christians who inhabit a liberal political order. It can be adapted and put to use in their civic projects and self-conceptions. It can provide theological warrant for resisting the temptation to sacralize the state or interfere in the religious lives of fellow citizens. The trouble, as I see it, is that Augustine did not recommend anything like the liberal norm of non-interference. In part, it's because he doubts that our social and political relationships can be truthfully described without acknowledging the many ways in which they are structured by laws that restrain action, customs that form habits, authorities that command obedience, and coercion that guarantees it. Persons and powers that interfere with human life and conduct, there's no escaping them, or reason to think that we should. But more importantly, it's because he had his attention fixed elsewhere, on the lust for domination that infects all human relationships, the side of Adam's fall. It's this combination, the ordinary reality of interference in every human relationship, and the lust for mastery, disordering every human soul, that captures Augustine's imagination and that places a question mark over political society. In his correspondence with North African magistrates, in his critique of Roman conquest, in his discussion of domestic and civil rule, and in his somewhat surprising willingness to defend state action against his religious opponents, the Donatists, in each case we find Augustine asking whether the customs, commands, and laws at work in a relationship are external expressions of this internal disorder. Do they mask the arbitrary will of the powerful and their desire for mastery? Or are there reasons that warrant the constraints placed on human life and action, reasons that refer to the norms of justice and love, norms that can be used to hold power accountable? Quite often, it's Augustine himself, in his role as bishop or pastor, who does this work of accountability. These roles give him authority to press the powerful for reasons. And quite often, we find him encouraging the occupant of some other paternal office, parent, priest, or magistrate, to act in accord with its norms. When he defends state action against the Donatists, his reasons refer to this same paternal logic. They are like children who have broken a promise and have lost their way. He is like a father who longs for their return and will do what he must in order to bring them home. Thankfully, our age is less willing to consider paternalistic relationships just. We distribute the authority to contest power more broadly, and we regard with suspicion those social and political relationships that resemble the relationship between parent and child. They are guilty until proven innocent. Doesn't mean that all are guilty. They just have to be assessed. These differences should not surprise us. Our age is not Augustine's. What matters, what we can learn from him nevertheless, is that domination is at work and dignity denied in far too many human relationships. As in his age, so in ours. Power is too often distributed unequally and exercised arbitrarily, without reasons that can account for its merit or bear witness to the dignity of the persons involved. The lust to dominate, a deliverance of our deepest dislocation from God and neighbor, finds expression in precisely these circumstances. The civic project of Christianity, however we regard it, should certainly include this aspect of Augustine's political thought. It should find a way to coordinate the concern for justice and its common good that we find in Pacem in Terris and Gaudium et Spes, the accent on law and citizenship, dignity and role that we find in Thomas, and the regard for domination and its lust that occupies Augustine. In this respect, as in so many others, Dr. King got it right. Thank you.
John, thank you. That was, I mean, you covered a lot of ground, and there's a lot of things in that essay, so I look forward to going back through it. But my initial question, it's a clarification question, and it's basically to try to figure out a little bit what kind of account of the natural law you're offering us here. As I understood you, this is basically an exercise in sacra doctrina, what you're doing here. You're giving us a vision of the natural law from within a Christological, distinctively theological account.
Correct.
And at the same time, in the way that Aquinas would say in the first question of the Summa, the theologian may use philosophical arguments internal to his theology. You are offering defenses of natural law, especially the account of justice you gave to some of your fellow Protestant theologians who are skeptical about justice and the subjectivized tradition. I presume that you think that those accounts of justice and natural law could find sympathetic auditors among our secular contemporaries who might accept that those arguments are licit and reasonable observations about the structure of reality itself.
Yes.
Without necessarily referencing the theological architecture.
Exactly, you've got it.
And yet, you are always trying to embed that articulation of natural law within the theological articulation.
Exactly.
Okay, so this is not a... Okay, all right.
So one way to put it is I'm trying to distinguish three things that often get run together in the discussion of natural law. So one is the metaphysical or theological account of an object.
Yeah.
Okay. The second is epistemic access to that account. And the third is the object itself. So, and the object will be, shared moral norms. Whatever agreement on moral norms that we can identify, that we might want to give an account of by means of metaphysical or theological discourse. I mean, the high ideal of natural law theory is to come up with a theory that packages all three of those things together. And what Hinger and I are basically saying, I think Russ and I are on the same page on this, is that if you want a theological upgrade of the account part, then the epistemic access to that account is not going to be shared by everybody. And thus, the role that natural law theory, theologically upgraded, might play in the civic project of Christianity is going to be complicated. And you've got to come up with a solution. Russ's solution is to go back to the Enlightenment and see if the natural law tradition can work out some sort of rapprochement with that. I'm a little dubious about that. I love Russ, but nevertheless. I think King's onto something. He's not opposed to a robustly metaphysical or theological account of the natural law. He just doesn't think it does any civic work, or it does minimal civic work. So he's going to talk about the natural law, but be rather vague about it. And he's not going to provide a theory. Rather, he's going to say, our basic agreement about certain deformities in human relationships actually bear witness to the fact that there are truths that transcend us. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, okay, so you're anticipating my follow-up question, which is there are people, you know, so I'm thinking of certain readers of Nietzsche who are going to want to problematize accounts of justice that are from the natural law tradition. For that matter, it doesn't really matter. It's not that important whether they come from, say, Aristotle, or they're a Christian or Aristotelianism embedded within sacra doctrina. And it might be important to try to give a more dense ontological defense of the foundations to those people. At least I would want to do that. Now, you could claim that you're doing that out narrating them, so to speak, about the structure of reality from within sacra doctrina and a theological account of ontology. But again, there we just have maybe, I'm wondering, wouldn't we just have parallel structures for you that you could give a different, a denser ontological account of human dignity and its ground in the Imago Dei and in the spiritual soul or something like that?
Yeah, so
and then some people would buy that, some people wouldn't from outside.
Yeah, and I'm, as I say, I'm perfectly happy with that. I want that. I'm less anxious, perhaps, than you are and others are about those Nietzschean anxieties. And not because I think those anxieties are right, I just think they're mistaken. I think they're kind of silly. Part of my work comes out of the kind of analytical neopragmatist tradition, the Davidson, Quine, Brandom, Wittgenstein. And it's hard, once you kind of read those guys, it's hard to muster real serious doubts about the discourses of justice, the basic discourses of justice. Or imagine radical relativism between communities and sources of discourse. I just can't get that worry going anymore. I did when I was 24, 25. But I can't anymore.
Well, I suspect that we would just have to have disagreements about how much effect that tradition is having in the world around us. But I'll pass.
No, I don't deny that there are ideological distortions that cause all sorts of trouble culturally and ecclesially. Absolutely. But I'm differing about what the philosophical and theological therapy for that is.
Can you hear me now?
I can, anyway. Yes.
This is a very small question, I think, built on a seconding of what you said about Augustine. Robert Marcus was a great man.
He was a great man, and I love his book.
His views, of course, were built on, in many ways, his own experience as a conscientious objector during the war.
Yep.
And his experience of his family in Eastern Europe.
Yep.
From the 19th century through to the...
It's a Cold War book in many ways.
Yeah, it's a Cold War book.
Yep.
I think that's exactly right.
Yep.
And more recent scholarship on Augustine has really swept away the Marcus's account, I think. You could list a whole series of,
yes.
of books on that. And I think one of the themes that really comes out of more recent literature is that Augustine is willing to make much more ad hoc calls to secular society, mm-hmm. to serve the purposes of the church.
Correct.
But almost always what he's trying to do is, it's not that he doesn't have a metaphysical sense of what dignity follows from being in the image of God, etc. Mm-hmm. He clearly does.
Yep.
But his purpose in according those rites, in letters to secular officials especially, mm-hmm. is to sort of set up an arc which links those rites towards conversion. So you should do this. Sometimes it comes across as, you should do this that the church can triumph.
Yes.
But often it's quite personal. It's, you should act like this because that's what a human being is, but you'll only understand what you're doing if it bends towards conversion.
If you come with us, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's that aspect of Augustine's work I didn't hear quite so much in the way that you were presenting. Were you avoiding that?
No, I'm not avoiding it at all. I think that's exactly right. You and I both read Augustine, but we stand in many ways in different subfields within it, right? So I hang out with the Christian ethicists and the political Augustinians, where Marcus's work, despite the criticisms, is still quite prominent, right? So the political Augustinians, they don't want to say that Augustine is some sort of proto-liberal, but they're worried that he might be because they've read Marcus, right?
They need to read more up-to-date scholars.
Of course they do. Of course they do. And all I want to say is that Augustine's... I think his central concern is actually unaccountable power within relationships.
Yeah.
He really cares about that. And it goes right down to his anthropology and his account of sin and his understanding of grace. I mean, it's much more theologically rich than this kind of proto-liberalism that we've had. So yes, I'll endorse everything you said.
All right, so please again, let's thank our speaker, Dr. John Boland.
Thank you.